You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Welcome to Scopes Monkey Choir.
This music is in a rational universe.
Yes, indeed.
This I'm Hai Ting.
I'm Matt.
I'm interrupting you.
Episode
today.
18.
It is episode 18.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, we took last week off with a vacation episode.
Yeah.
Sent you some fart sounds.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're also still incredibly busy, but we ran out of reserve episodes, so we're completely unprepared and... Well,
fortunately, we're professional musicians, so
yeah.
This week, we're going to talk about something that's inspired by the project that Matthew is working on right now, and which is going to be... performed, which is going to have its opening performance tomorrow night in New York City.
Or tonight, because this may be posted in the morning.
Ah, yes, it's going to have
Sunday.
Its premiere on Sunday,
If
February.
You're in New York and you get interested, we'll put links on the show page. Now, we normally don't, as regular listeners know, we don't normally talk about what we're doing, but every once in a while, a project seems like it might be of interest, so.
And this is pretty fascinating from a science standpoint. The project is called The Splits.
The Splits. And what happens when you split an instrument in half? I was commissioned by a sculptor who does just that. She takes string instruments and splits them in half vertically.
What's her name?
Jane Benson.
Jane Benson.
She commissioned me to write music for split instruments. She's done a total of, she split two violins, a viola, a cello, and a bass, which, when they're split, comes to a total of 10 instruments.
5 times 2 is 10.
No, we're good.
Man, we are a science podcast.
Yeah, so the higher strings, the two strings that make the higher notes are on one side, and the two strings that make the lower notes on the other side. And then they're just open. The body is open, and she does a little bit of adjustment just to make sure that the two halves can still be playable, to make sure that they don't collapse, because that's one of the challenges, is that the tension when you, for instance, a violin is tuned to its full tension, it has about 50 pounds of pressure.
On each string or all together?
No, all together.
Oh.
And then the violin strings are going over the bridge which is holding it up off the body. And that bridge, that equals about 20 pounds just in that one place on the bridge.
Downward pressure.
Yeah. The top of the violin, what they call the belly of the violin.
That's the part that has the F holes in it.
Right. That part is only a few millimeters thick, but it has 20 pounds of pressure coming down on it. So...
how many millimeters thick?
Just a couple. I don't know exactly.
A few millimeters. Wow. Yeah.
So there are some challenges, and that's what I thought we'd talk about that, of just what the challenges are about what happens when you split an instrument in half. Let's start. Let me play a tiny bit of what it sounds like, what a split violin sounds like. Yeah, so you get the idea. If you know the Chinese instrument, the erhu, which is basically the Chinese violin, it sounds a bit like that. Now, let's talk a little bit about how violins make sound. That is, unsplit violins.
We mentioned this briefly in our podcast on the harmonic series, but we did not go into detail.
So basically, when you have these strings, and you bow across the strings, you're vibrating the strings... and that makes sounds because it vibrates the air. Pretty straightforward. But the truth of the matter is that an actual vibrating string on its own is pretty quiet. And anyone who's ever stretched a rubber band and plucked it knows that. You can hear it. There's a tone there, but it's not very loud at all. It's certainly not as loud as a violin.
I'd like to hear an orchestra of rubber bands.
I am sure someone has done that. There are two other ways that the violin makes sound. Now... You commonly talking about instruments like a violin or a guitar or something like that, you say that the body amplifies the sound of the strings, and that's not quite accurate. It's perfectly reasonable to say that because the end result is the same. The sound gets louder. But what's actually happening in a violin is that there are two other sources of the sound. The string is vibrating, and that's pretty quiet. But then the vibrations of the string are, they go through the bridge, and then once again the belly of the violin, the sort of flat part under the strings, that also vibrates and makes a sound. But then also inside the violin, the air is vibrating and making another sound, which is only released because of the F holes. You have to have those holes so that the sound has some way to get out. So whereas some instruments are actually taking the wave, the sound wave, and through shape and design sort of amplify the wave to make it louder, and the violin and similar instruments, what's actually happening is that the string is making a small sound, and then the wood is making another sound, and the air inside the instrument is making a third sound.
So the vibration of the string is being directly transferred to the wood of the violin, which is then vibrating in turn and making the air vibrate as well.
Right.
And then that air is reaching your ear, as opposed to a tubular instrument, the woodwinds and the brass, where the small vibration of your lips is creating a standing wave inside the tube, and that is a compression wave rather than a lateral wave. I forget the name for the string wave, the up and down string, as opposed to the kind of in and out wave that is an air wave.
Right.
So different mechanism.
It's cool though. I mean, I've never really thought about it that way. That it's actually not amplifying the sound. It's actually there are three different sounds. They all happen to be vibrating in the same frequency, which is why you get the sound. But you can see also why different instruments that work like that, different string instruments and such, will have slightly different sounds. And it also gives you because it's actually a combination of three different sounds.
And actually, I was realizing as I was saying that of course the air that is vibrating on the inside of the violin is a compression wave. So you have
right.
you have the string wave, and you have the vibration of the basically flat wood of the violin, and then you have a compression wave set up by those things
right.
inside the body of the violin.
But it's also interesting because it helps to understand why when you hear people talk about violins and people get all discussing the details and the way it's made, and I'm sure you've all heard about people talking about the Stradivari violins and how they're the greatest violins ever made,
one really knows exactly why they are the greatest violins ever made, but maybe there are some studies that show that they were chemically treated in a way that was lost or kept secret
right.
or stolen from Amati, who was another famous violin maker, blah, blah, blah.
So all that stuff, but it sort of makes you realize why every single detail of an instrument like that is actually going to make a difference to the sound, because you have these three sounds being combined, and the wood vibrating is going to sound different depending on what kind of wood you use, what kind of finish it has. The air vibration inside the instrument is going to have a different sound depending on the shape of the instrument, the shape of the F holes, also the wood too, how it vibrates in there, and then the strings themselves. There are very different kinds of strings that you can get for an instrument like that, and they're all going to have slightly different sounds. And you can just see how these factors will add up and this huge variety of sound possibilities. And you can sort of see why people get all worked up about it.
There was one thing that I believe I mentioned in the Harmonic Series podcast that we could touch on again about this in relation to the splits, which is this. The vibrations that are happening in the strings are of different frequencies depending on where you put your fingers on the fingerboard. That's how you get the different pitches. And the body of the violin is in that extremely complex shape with the little bowed shape in on the sides and the very careful curve of it and the curved F holes, which are those F-shaped holes in the front of the violin. Partially that shape is so complicated because you need the violin to be able to resonate at all of the frequencies that the violin can make, instead of just very specific frequencies that a simpler form like a box would resonate to more easily.
Right. So by having a complicated shape like that, you sort of increase the areas that can then can create
sympathetically vibrate.
Right,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, isn't it correct that there, even in a great violin, there are certain notes that are going to resonate more than others?
Yes, and there are certain notes that do not resonate well, usually very few, but they're called wolf tones.
Right.
They're basically particular pitches that the instrument, be it a violin, a viola, a cello, or a bass, is just very reluctant to resonate to. And this is something that you really ran into when the instruments are cut in half.
Yeah, it becomes a real problem. Part of that is because violins are, well, we should explain why the wolf tone happens. The wolf tone happens, it's a resonance problem, but it actually happens when there's too close a match between the resonance, the vibration of the string, and the resonance of the instrument.
What?
Yeah. If they're too close, then they sort of get engaged in a little battle. So
they sort of can't try to cancel each other out?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And over the years, violin makers developed a technique where they managed to make the body in a way that you cannot avoid a wolf tone. It's just a physical property of the universe, verse, because you have the body resonates and the string resonates, and there's no way to avoid it. But what you can do is you can build the body in a certain way so that that note, which is going to wolf, as they say, the wolf tone note is going to be actually between two pitches that are normally used in the Western scale.
Oh.
So it's not generally a big problem for violins. It's more of a problem. Cellos have the biggest problem with wolf tones. There are things you can do about it. There's a wolf tone eliminator you can put on that basically sort of dampens that one frequency.
It's like those little deer things you put on your car to scare away.
Yeah.
Deer bitch scares away the wolf.
Yeah, similar.
Wait. No, I totally was making up that joke and not listening to your explanation. So try
it's
again.
All right. It's all right.
Well, the podcast listeners were paying attention.
Yeah, and we're talking about wolf tones. Now there are all these dogs barking, but they probably can't hear that, so... Well, yeah, I mean, that's the wolf tone. So, but what's happened is that splitting the instruments has caused the wolf tones to come out and growl and bark. All of them have quite bad wolf tones. And so part of this project has been just working with the instrumentalists on the concert to try to eliminate them as much as possible, the various ways of doing that. It works sometimes to just stuff something in the body of the instrument. And guess what? When you split an instrument in half, it's a lot easier to stuff something in the instrument. we also are using wolf eliminators.
Now, tell me again, what does the wolf eliminator look like?
It's a very small... There are different kinds, but most of them, they're very small, you know, maybe size of a dime or something for a violin or a viola. Cello one is like a tiny cylinder, maybe, but they're all just, you know, centimeter or two wide, and they actually go on the string on the opposite side of the bridge from where you're bowing.
Oh.
So they're attached to the string, so they affect the vibration, but they don't dampen the sound.
I never knew what those little things were. I've been around so many string players.
They're also
really
mutes, which can look similar to.
No, I know what a mute looks like. Yeah. Thank you very much. That's a little rubber thing that goes that sits on the side of the on the short part of the strings, on top of the bridge, not the part that you vibrate with the bow, and you can flip it onto the bridge to just exactly dampen the sound of the string and mute it.
Yeah. Well, and then we'll get more into that. I'm sure we're going to do a three-part podcast episode, three parts about the mute, because there's nothing really to say. It just mutes it.
Well, we're going to talk about mutes.
So another thing which we've been doing to eliminate the wolf tones is the sound post. Now, the sound post in a string instrument is actually very important. It is literally just a little post. It looks like a little dowel, dowel rod type thing that goes inside the instrument. It goes underneath the bridge, and it has this dual function. It simultaneously keeps the instrument from collapsing, by holding it up because of that, the tension.
20 pounds of pressure downward on the millimeters of
it does that, but what it also does is that it transfers the vibrations of the strings through the bridge to the other side of the instrument and gets more vibration from the instrument.
The back of the instrument that's usually made of that special curly maple.
So it's been actually interesting having the split instruments. It makes it really easy to move the sound post. Normally on a violin, moving the sound post is a big deal because you have to get in there with like little scalpel, not scalpel type things, whatever, model making. You can't just grab it.
Don't you usually have to send it to a luthier to
I
do that
think
for you?
Normally you would, yeah. But when they're split, it's just right there. You can move around. And so we've been experimenting with that, and it's quite interesting. And it's a lesson in acoustics because not only does where you move the sound post make a difference in where the wolf tone is or isn't, it changes what note the wolf tone is on and makes it less in some spots and others, but you can hear just the slightest move of the sound post changes the sound of the whole instrument. I mean, in a way that you only notice if you have about, you know, a sort of back and forth, you know, it still sounds like a split violin, but but it's fascinating. You just move it just, you know, a centimeter or so, and the instrument sounds totally different. And then you move it over another inch, and I'm mixing my, and then it sounds totally different. And it's really amazing. And once again, as a reminder of there's a reason that people get all persnickety about how instruments are made and how every little detail makes a huge difference in how it sounds.
Well, is that enough about split instruments?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Perhaps after the concert tomorrow, maybe at some point I'll put up some audio from the concert if people want to hear a whole group of split instruments making noise.
Yeah, so this concert is going to be at what time?
Yeah, it's put on the webpage. It's in New York City. 7 p.m.
7 p.m. at the Henry Street Settlement, for those of you who know where that is. And then the split instruments, which will be just fascinating to look at anyway, will be on display there for
a few weeks after that.
A few weeks, yeah, as Jane Benson's
installation.
Installation, yeah. Art installation.
And then, so we're going to spend a little bit more time on the instrument du jour this week than normal because we have an interview. And stuff.
Are we? It's a very short interview. Why don't we hear the instrument du jour?
Okay.
From, is it last week's or this week's?
It was 2 weeks ago.
Oh, right. All right, let's refresh our memories.
Yeah. So here it is. All right. Well, it goes on like that. Yeah, I'll put it on in the background. And,
So what is that, Matthew?
That is it's called Phantom of the Floppera. And it is Bach played on floppy disks, floppy disk drives.
On a floppy disk drive. Yeah. A single one or several?
Four. Yeah. So, and there's, to many of you nerds out there, this won't be news.
What? Our listeners aren't nerds.
No, yes they are. There's a fair amount of this out there. These have been around for years. People have made lots of videos of them. And it's just this way of taking old hardware that doesn't have any other particularly good use, and you make music out of it. And instead of me describing how it works, because
I found an expert.
Yeah, because we're nerds, but we're not that flavor of nerd. We're a different flavor of nerd. The flavor of nerd that involves hardware and computer programming, that's not us.
I found an expert. I'm working on a film shoot at the moment, which involves some both music and robotics. So I dragged one of our techies into the bathroom today during a break and made him explain how this thing works. So here's Ed Baer, and he opens by telling you what he does, and I completely failed to be skeptical about it, but I think you'll understand that he was just being funny.
Yeah, I think that's clear. All right, here we go.
So Ed, say hi to the listeners of Scopes Monkey Choir.
Hi.
And tell them your name.
My name is Ed Baer, and
what do you do?
I'm a professional alchemist. I take crystals and metals and raw materials out of the earth and out of the trash, and then I shape them into special geometric configurations that they produce light and sound and motion.
Excellent. And so what can you tell us about this instrument that people have made out of old floppy disk drives?
Well, the basic idea is the basic idea behind the generation of most sound. It's that is, if you shake something, it will shake the air around it, and then you will hear it as sound. And what you're shaking in this case is the motor, which would be spinning a magnetic disk. What you would normally hear is that motor running at a constant speed, but you create musical tones by varying the speed or the frequency that that motor is running at. And so if you, you know, very roughly, if you wanted to play a pitch, let's say A 440, which is 440 hertz, you would want to spin that motor 440 times a second.
Is that equivalent to somehow running 440 hertz of electricity into it, or is it not quite that simple?
It is ideally simply equivalent to it. In fact, if you sing into a microphone at 440 hertz, that there is a signal, an electrical signal, in that cable going from the mic to wherever it's going at 440 hertz. Very literally. You're shaking the electrons in the wire at 440 hertz, and that's the signal. That's really it. So most of the disk drive or similar instruments that I've seen really just focus on finding a place in the disk drive where you can send it a low level, a low power signal, maybe even a digital signal, to control the frequency that the motors in it are spinning.
Awesome. And I guess people have done this with scanners and printers and things too, all kinds of old electronics.
Yeah, even some of the most fun videos I've seen are when they do it with industrial robots.
Oh, cool.
Like giant welding robots or big 3-4-axis CNC machines, like the type of thing that you would carve a car out of a solid block of steel.
Very cool. Have you ever made any of these?
I've played around with similar things. Mm-hmm. I actually have a little wah-wah pedal, which died, and I kind of converted to a similar idea, where it's kind of like a drum machine, but the primary sound source is a set of different motors that I ripped out of tape players, and it's got a quarter-inch jack, and you just plug different motors in to get different tones, and then you can kind of... But the motor is just out and raw, you can hold it, and so you can kind of stop it and play it with your hand to kind of get different effects. So, you know.
Very cool. Thank you so much for sharing that. And now we will vacate the bathroom on this film shoot where we're hiding away. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Ed Bear.
Thank
what
you,
a peach.
Ed. Yeah. We will link to his webpage on our show page.
Since he mentioned that people have done it with other hardware, I want to play one other little bit.
Oh, nice. Excellent.
Just, like I say, there's tons of stuff out there, but I love this one, so I'm going to play a little bit of it.
Wow, that's played live. It's not sampled and stuck together.
Yeah, well, if the video is to be believed, and I don't see why not to believe it, all the sounds are very convincing. He's got mics up against all the hardware, and that's a Radiohead, a cover of a Radiohead song.
And that is way more interesting than any rubber band orchestra could ever be.
Yeah, I just think it's so pretty. I almost like it more than the Radiohead song itself.
How dare you.
I don't know about that, because, you know, the voice thing. But so that's a scanner, a dot matrix printer, and a ZX Spectrum, which is a home computer from 1982. That's the one that does the actual tones.
Mm-hmm.
And then a whole bunch of hard drives, which are doing the sort of, quote, voice, quote.
What's all the percussion?
That's the dot matrix printer.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So pretty. I mean, that's been around for 3 years. Millions of people have seen it, so it's may not be new to everyone, but I couldn't resist. I wanted to. There's also
it was
this,
new to me, and I was very glad to hear it.
Oh, that's good. There's also a good Star Wars Imperial theme on floppy disk drive. I'll link to on the page.
Maybe we can find one of those industrial robots as well.
Yeah, maybe. I'm too busy though. You can all find that yourselves, I'm sure. I'm tired of linking.
All right, well, before we finish up, I just want to make one announcement of my own, which is that I've had a project in the very beginning stages of development for a little while here, and it is called Science Fair, and it has just been accepted to a development program at the Here Theater, Here, H-E-R-E. Theater in New York, in Soho, and I will be developing it over the next 1 to 3 years. It is going to be scientific texts set to music, including texts on astronomy, evolution, biology, and then finally a section of classroom science experiments set to music. It's all going to be kind of choreographed as well to look pretty, but be educational for everyone, not for children, not just for children. and anyone who has any science texts that they think might be really great set to classical music, please send them in to us. And especially if you know science experiments that are particularly dramatic or informative or make nice noises, send your descriptions in to me, and I may well set them to music and perform them.
No acids, please. No experiments involving acid.
Okay.
All right, that's my rule, not yours. It's your project, not mine.
In any case, and look out for bits of Science Fair to be presented at various occasions, including perhaps skeptical meetups and things like that. Speaking of skeptical meetups, we both will be at Nexus, N-E-C-S-S.
Nexus.
The Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism, which will take place here in New York City on April
9th and 10th.
9th and 10th. Will we play a promo for it?
Yeah. We'll play a promo instead of our usual outro music, we'll do that. Oh, wait, we have to do the teaser for next week's instrument du jour. Okay, here it is.
Oh, right.
Right.
Next week's instrument du jour.
Okay, here it is. Okay, so tune in next week, and we'll tell you what it is.
Thank you for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir.
From ScopesMonkeyChoir.com, blah, 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 blah. See you next week.
Bye.
Cool. What is that?
Oh, it's the schedule of speakers for Nexus.
Nexus?
Yeah, it's the Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism.
Oh, are you going?
Yeah.
Nice. Tell me, what is Nexus?
What's Nexus? Oh, well, it's an educational conference held annually in New York City. Nexus explores the intersection of science, skepticism, the media, and society for the purpose of promoting a more rational world.
How does that spell Nexus?
What?
How does that spell Nexus? It's N-E-C-S-S. Should be Nexus.
What?
Should be pronouncing Nexus. I not know English so good, but N-E-C-S-S no spell Nexus.
Well, okay, yeah, but Nexus.
Nexus. What's wrong with Nexus? Nechesasa. I have brother-in-law. His name is Nechesasa.
You do?
No, but I could. Nechesasa. It rolls off the tongue.
Your tongue, maybe.
What?
Nothing.
So who is speaker going to be at Nechesasa?
Nexus.
Whatever. Tell me who.
Well, scheduled to appear are Brooke Allen,
Jay Novella,
Evan Bernstein,
Steve Novella,
Hal Bidla,
John Allen Powell,
Julia Galef,
Massimo Pigliucci,
Dan Garden,
John Rennie,
Thomas Gilovich,
Todd Robbins,
Jennifer Michael Hecht,
Eugenia C. Scott,
George Hrob,
Rebecca Watson,
Daniel Kahneman,
Carl Zimmer,
Bob Novella,
and keynote speaker Phil Plait.
Ooh, he's Death from the Space Man.
Death from the Skies, right.
Listen, how you do that?
Do what?
Make your voice all bouncy, bouncy like that.
Well, I am a podcaster.
Ooh, it's very nice. Tell me, what is podcasting?
Nexus.
Nexus, sir.
Shh. The Northeast Conference for Science and Skepticism, April 9th and 10th in New York City. Go to nexuscon.org or check out our Facebook page and Twitter feed.